maybe it was a couple of years ago that I actually met Michael briefly in person when I was able to attend a symposium, a day-long symposium in San Rafael at the Calliopeia Foundation. And Michael was moderating that symposium, and five or six really remarkable people presented something about their own work, and Michael would make the introductions and engage in a little conversation with each person. It was an inspiring day, and I was really struck by Michael's sensitivity, his warmth, and articulateness during that day. And I was glad that I got to be there in the same room with him after having heard so much about him. So I trust that everyone today has read the wonderful little write-up that we've been given. So I don't really feel I need to go over that. You know, I've done a little research and looked at the Commonweal website, and I have the feeling there's so much material there, wonderful material. And there's a few things that really stand out for me. Maybe the central theme, a quote here, "The heart of being human is a search for meaning." To me, that's just an amazing and wonderful statement, which I know must be a key that underlies everything. And then I was also struck by how Michael focused on political science as a student at Harvard and Yale. And then somehow I'll be interested to hear how that sort of ends up with a focus with Commonweal, and that how Commonweal started with a vision. And I know we'll want to know more about that. Commonweal website, there's three prominent headings: health and healing, education and the arts, and environment and justice. So, I mean, that covers an awful lot of ground. And looking at the website, I noticed that Michael had two co-founders, Carolyn Brown and Burr Henneman. So, Michael, I wonder if, you know, to start with, I'm wondering, where are your co-founders today?
Well, Richard, first of all, thank you for inviting me, and Kanchan, thank you, and also Nipun. I'm just so grateful to be talking with this extraordinary global community, and I have such respect for service space and for the whole Awaken community, and so I just want to say how honored I am to actually be talking live with this global community with which I so profoundly share values. So I just want to start there. In response to your question, Carolyn Brown, who co-founded Commonweal with me, and before that, we co-founded a school for kids out of juvenile halls and mental hospitals called Full Circle, which ran for 30 years. So when I left Yale, the first thing I did when I got to California, just speaking of stories, was I was at Yale working with the Carnegie Council on Children, came out to explore what was happening with children in California, and by accident met a little girl who had been diagnosed retarded until she was taken off gluten and dairy products, and as kind of swam up out of these severe allergic reactions and turned out to be learning disabled but not retarded. And I had studied child psychology at Harvard and Yale, and no one had ever mentioned that nutrition could affect consciousness. And that was such a profound revelation that I resigned from a tenure track teaching a position at Yale to start this school for delinquent kids in West Marin County called Full Circle, where we looked at the role of nutrition in the learning and behavior disorders of children. And just briefly, I discovered over a number of years that there were a small number of kids who had these very dramatic responses to changing nutrition. Then there were a large number where, you know, nutrition mattered, but it wasn't decisive. And then there were others where nutrition didn't matter at all. And so Carolyn Brown was the co-founder of that with me, and I worked with Carolyn from 1972 when I came out here until her death about 10 years ago. Burr Henneman is still part of the Commonweal community. He is a very renowned conservationist. He's did seminal work at Commonweal on ocean policy reform and ran the Commonweal Oceans program, which changed the legislation in California for how California oceans are regulated and governed, got it passed through the legislature and signed by the governor, and then spent years implementing it. So in both cases, as you said, it's hard to, there's not a good word for what Commonweal is, but you can think of it in two ways. One, in the language of awaken and service space, Commonweal is really about healing ourselves and healing the earth, and that's exactly what service space and awaken, as I understand them, are about. It's like service to others, and in the course of service to others, we also awaken ourselves. And so the other language that I'd use in a more entrepreneurial context would be that you can think of Commonweal as sort of a think and do tank. We're not just about thinking, we're about doing. And in fact, so we will have an impulse or an intuition that we can make a contribution, and we'll have an idea about how that contribution can develop, but we only really come to understand how it will develop by actually doing it. And by doing it, the opportunities open and the work shows us what it is intended to be. And that will end up, because we work in community, we have a shared wisdom and a shared understanding that is greater than the wisdom or understanding of any single person. And so, in effect, a third consciousness develops separate from our own individual consciousnesses, and that guides the work. So it is by engaging in service that we discover the wisdom as to how the work is to be done and become part of a community of awareness that actually guides the work beyond what we could have imagined.
Wow. All I can say is wow. That's a very beautiful setting forth. The think and do tank. We need more think and do tanks, I think.
I think they're all over the world, actually. You know, Paul Hawkins' extraordinary book called Blessed Unrest really is such a contribution because, you know, what Paul said is if you look at the problems facing the world, you cannot help but despair. But if you look at the grassroots efforts all over the world to address the problems that people face in their communities, that these grassroots efforts are like a global immune system, and that they are drawn to the wounded places, and they begin to work. And because they are working on very concrete realities, they tend not to be ideological. They tend to bring people together in service to some specific wound that the community is facing. And so, from my point of view, it's so easy for us to despair over, you know, the colossal problems of climate change and toxic chemicals, habitat destruction, invasive species, you know, income
yeah.
disparities, injustice, war, you know, the list goes on forever.
Yeah.
It is easy to despair, but despair is, you know, it's a very unproductive way to live. And we can't know what the future will actually be, but living in service and doing what we can engenders a form of hope, a form of resilience that is part of creating the global consciousness that can move us through these very, very difficult times. So, and to me, that is what service space, that is what awaken are about. They are precisely about this process. And so I am learning at least as much from my engagement with your communities as you could possibly learn from me?
Well, that again is so helpful to hear you put this thing out so clearly. There's a real key point in what you're talking about, and I want to ask you about that. And that is that point on the fulcrum, or that point where something changes from an idea or a vision into a doing. That is a huge kind of gap, the gap between sort of a thought or a vision and actually doing something about that. And that's one of the things that's impressed me so much with what I've learned about you, is that you exemplify the capacity and the courage and whatever it is that helps a person move from having a vision, as you have put up on your website, and actually trying to do something about it. Can you say something about that point of crossing that threshold and what it takes, what it's been for you?
Well, I think for some of us, I think it's just innate for some of us. It's just, in other words, I see absolutely no difference between what we do at Commonweal and what anybody in the service-based community or beyond does when we simply are impelled to offer some small act of kindness to somebody. In other words, when you see someone in trouble, you know, someone who's fallen down on the street, or, you know, someone who needs something, we are biologically designed to respond. It just is an innate response. In fact, if we don't respond, there's probably some block of some kind that has developed in us. We are biologically designed to respond when we see a need, a human need, a need of some kind. And, you know, when I think about this, I think about when we go back to what the great traditions, virtually all of them, the perennial philosophy at the heart of all the traditions, tell us about what it means to be human. What are we given? We're given, you know, our heads, our thoughts, our minds. We're given our hearts, our capacity for compassion, kindness. And we're given our hands, which is acts of service and so on. And if you go back, you know, for example, to the Bhagavad Gita, what are the three great yogas of the Bhagavad Gita that compete for supremacy? They are Jnana Yoga, the yoga of wisdom. There's Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of the heart. And there's Karma Yoga, the yoga of the hands. And I've been so fascinated because this is biologically designed. We all have heads, we all have hearts, we all have hands. So, you know, that is, you know, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga. And in every tradition, you find those three things in one form or another. You know, in Christianity, faith is Jnana Yoga, love is Bhakti Yoga, hope is Karma Yoga. You find the same in every tradition. And so, to me, we each are designed with different ratios, in some sense, of the degree to which we serve with our minds, serve with our hearts, serve with our hands. But the traditions tell us that the greatest of these yogas is, at least in the Bhagavad Gita, actually in some of the other traditions, it's the yoga of the mind. But the Gita and many of the great spiritual traditions teach us that the yoga of love, of compassion, of kindness, is the greatest of all three. And that if that is foremost, the yoga of the heart, that the mind is a wonderful servant to that, and the hands enacted in the world. So to me, it isn't how I or others make the leap from thought to service, to action in the world. It is that these three things are innate in us, and we each just have different preferences, perhaps even at different times in our lives. You know, awaken, this wonderful idea of waking up with kin, with our kindred, you know, spirits, with those who are aligned with us. When we come together in community like that, we are just impelled towards some form of service.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you spoke of the head, the heart, and the hands, because that's one of the things that it seems to me that for us to be really whole and healed, we need all three, the head, the heart, and the hands, to be part of our lives as a kind of integrated unity, connected somehow. And that seems to be one of the ways in which we are not, as a culture, and I'm speaking now of the West, the U.S., and it seems to me like we are such a predominantly head culture in our heads, that we sit in front of computers and so forth, and in our heads, anything's possible as a thought. But what is often missing in me is my heart and my body. I'm guessing this makes sense to you, what I'm saying.
It does make sense to me, very much so. But I think there are different ways of being in our heads. So, for example, let me go back. I've just been fascinated as I've been looking at the Awaken website. You know, Awaken is about deepening our self-awareness in a community of kindred spirits. By changing ourselves, we change the world. We offer three ways to do this. Go within, go local, and then go online in terms of engagement with, people essentially doing Dharma talks. And so when in the circles that you talk about, folks convene for an hour of group meditation followed by a circle of sharing and a meal. Well, I just want to talk about the genius of this model, you know, for a moment, because you meditate for an hour, right? That's a substantial meditation. And then you share what comes up from that, and then you celebrate it with a meal, right? Yeah. And this is happening in over 60 countries around the world. So from my point of view, when one meditates for an hour, or when one meditates even more modestly, I rarely get to an hour. But my own experience is that in silence, that I connect with intuition about what I am called to do or how I am called to understand what is happening to me. And so it seems to me that that is the higher form of mind. And in the traditions, this is the way, in some sense, instruction comes to us. And when we think about what happens in communities of people all over the world who are dedicated to meditation or prayer, it just naturally pulls us toward a vision of what humanity can be. And what is evoked by meditation or prayer is kindness. Mm-hmm. And out of that kindness equally is evoked service. So to my mind, these practices, as Awaken does them, as people all over the world do them, pull us into a pattern, a collective pattern of what we can be, both individually, in our small groups, in our communities, and as a species on this earth. So I see this model of, I guess going back to your point, yes, we are in our minds in the West, but in a very typically concrete way, you know, we are accessing the lower mind, if you wish, but we are less likely to access the higher mind, and we know that the higher mind exists. You know, neurophysiology, neuropsychology, there's just more and more evidence that we can go to a place beyond the lower ego, and awaken to a much more global sense of who we are and what our purpose is.
Thank you. And that is amazing to hear you speak. I'm going to make a little leap here, not a big leap, but sort of entering the education and the arts thing, which is already related. I think everything is related in what you're talking about. But you've got something called the New School, and that's a hopeful title in itself, the New School. And I know you're kind of, these things are interrelated, so you may be end up repeating yourself, but what is behind that phrase, the New School?
Well, actually, my father was a political philosopher named Max Lerner, and I grew up in New York City, and he used to teach at a wonderful place that came out of the Holocaust, really, and the movement of Jewish intellectuals to New York and the United States. And there was a place called the New School for Social Research in New York. It still exists. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful place filled with all kinds of classes for all kinds of people. And so when I came out to California, started Commonweal, and, you know, we were doing all this sort of strongly focused service work over time, you know, with kids in trouble, with cancer patients, with the environment, and so on. There was a part of me, the part that I had loved teaching at Yale, that I wanted to continue to have these conversations. It's very much like what you've done with Works and Conversations, actually. And so it took me a long time. Actually, it took me about 32 years to get around to doing it. But about 7 years ago, because Commonweal's about 40 years old now, I just couldn't stand it anymore. So I started doing conversations with people. And now we've done about 200 of them over the last 7 years. I don't do all of them, but I've done the majority. With all kinds of wonderful people, Brother David Steindl-Rast, Angelus Arian, Rachel Naomi Remen, Ram Dass, you know, Bill Drayton from Ashoka, and people nobody knows, too. And so the New School is just my way of having a tremendous amount of fun. It's just such a joy. And so I pick people that I passionately want to talk with and review their work for, you know, a week or two and then have a conversation with them. And a lot of just you spoke of the interrelatedness, because what I'd like to turn to for a minute, since we said this is what the call would be about, is this is what Wounded Healers are about. Is that okay, Richard,
oh,
if we
please
talk about it?
Yeah. Please do, yes.
Because, you know, and this goes, again, to the deep parallels between Service Station and Awaken and our work at Commonweal. The Wounded Healer is an archetype of human experience that Carl Jung talked about. And the basis of the archetype is that the way people come to an interest in healing is through their own wounds, that when we get sick or when we experience some deep loss in our lives, that we can get stuck in depression and grief forever. But there is another way, and that is that our wound opens us to essentially a greater awareness of our own souls and of a greater reality, a reality behind the everyday reality, that when someone we love dies, when we develop an illness, when we have a great loss of some kind or other, that the shock of that loss opens us to, I would say, a higher reality or a greater reality, or it can. And, you know, we've done, right now, as I speak to you, we are coming to the end of our 181st Commonweal Cancer Help Program retreat. So over the last 30 years, I've co-led 181 of these retreats for people with cancer at Commonweal, a week of yoga, meditation, deep relaxation, support groups, healing arts work, so on. And in the course of a week, what really happens is that this impulse to awaken to a greater reality accelerates in the people who are here. And by working in community together, just as Awaken does, with meditation and then sharing, there is a great strengthening of the relationship to the higher self or the deeper self or a greater reality, whatever you want to call it, each person in their own individual way. Well, the point about this is there's absolutely nothing new about this. The archetype of the wounded healer is one of the most ancient in human history. And it is exemplified in the shamanic tradition of all indigenous peoples all around the world. There is no indigenous tradition without a shamanic presence. And the shamans were those women and men who had what was called an initiatory illness. And through that initiatory illness, through their own wound, as they came very close to death or just to a complete sense of, just being totally blown open, they came to know that if they recovered, they wanted to dedicate their lives to helping other people with this process. And that shamanic tradition, along with the incest taboo, are the two cultural invariants all over the world and all indigenous people. So this is the shamanic impulse, which is the impulse of the wounded healer, is founded on the bedrock of what it means to be human. So just to complete this linkage, if this is true of us as individuals, then what do we know about the wounds that we experience as communities, as nations, and as a global species? Well, if we look at what we're going through right now at a global level, we have created a global wound. And that global wound can just plunge us into despair, but it also has the possibility of a fundamental transformation of human consciousness that will lead us to an awareness that we are all a community. And in the Cancer Help Program, and when one does this in community, what opens is a awareness of actual love, of compassion, that really opens to people who are very different from ourselves, that we recognize, in the Cancer Help Program, that it doesn't matter what people did for a living or what their belief system was or any of that stuff. What matters is that in the circle of the Cancer Help Program, we share a wound and we are brothers and sisters, or we are beloved of each other in that circle. So I think there's real historic evidence of the growth of human consciousness through the great wounding shocks that have taken place. So this is what gives me hope, is that we can learn that the wounded healer bridges the gap between individual experience, group experience, and global consciousness, and that it is fundamentally important because it's beyond all ideologies and religions and is based on the bedrock of human experience.
Listening to you, Michael, I'm almost rendered speechless, which is not a good thing for me as the moderator. It's just amazing. I don't know if you want to share anything about your own story in relationship to being a wounded healer or not. Is that something that you'd be willing to share anything about?
I can do that, and I will a little bit, but let me say something about that, which is we live in a time, it's not a bad thing, where the way we interact with each other is with personal stories, and I'm happy to do that. But I think that there is something to be said for the wisdom of going to the archetypal level, which goes beyond our individual stories to that which we all share. And so, for example, when we talk about the wounded healer, that's one archetype. But let me give you another example just of an archetypal experience that we all share. And that is the experience of what happens when we fall in love, right? And if you if, you know, most people on this call at some point or another in their lives have fallen in love. And in archetypal terms, this is the archetypal psychology of Carl Jung and James Hillman and others. What happens is that in the Western mythology, but it's absolutely present in Hindu mythology and all the others, is that the god of love, who is given enormous power, shoots an arrow and wounds Psyche, and Psyche begins to suffer. And the god of love is suffering because he's in love with Psyche, Eros, or whoever you want to call it, and Psyche is this originally virginal woman who begins to suffer. And what happens is that through their shared suffering, having fallen in love, they both essentially are forced through this suffering, again, awakening through suffering, to mature to what in alchemy is called the alchemical marriage, which takes place, you know, through this suffering. And so consciousness moves forward, is impelled forward by the suffering that takes place when we fall in love. Hmm. And so I just give that, we could follow that out at great length. But we all have certain common archetypal experiences that go beyond our individual experiences. We have the experience of being wounded. We have the experience of falling in love. We have the experience of facing death. We have the experience of whatever is newborn for us, whether it's children. We have the experience of service. So I'm happy to talk about myself, but I think what really pulls us together is when we move from the individual story to the great archetypal stories that we share.
Well, thank you for that. there's certainly many more questions. one of the questions I want to ask you about has to do with the environment. And I think I can't even remember exactly a bumper sticker I saw years ago, some environmentalist, and the bumper sticker was something to the effect that just keep God out of it, out of this. It occurs to me that the environmental movement requires some kind of spiritual element. It seems that I just wondered what your thoughts are about the environment in terms of a spiritual aspect to it.
Right. Well, that's a wonderful question, and let me address it in several different ways. The first one is that I'm very interested in the place where spiritual and secular meet. And my colleague, Rachel Naomi Remen, whose work you know, remarkable physician who wrote Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings, and her program at Commonweal, the Healers, the Institute for the Study of Health and Illness, has a project called The Healer's Art that is in 70 medical schools around the world. And so Rachel has a way of talking that secular people and spiritual people find equally accessible. And I love that because I think that if we are to do what we are supposed to do as human beings, we need to recognize that some people are naturally drawn to secular metaphors and others are naturally drawn to religious or to spiritual metaphors. And yet what we share in common goes beyond those differences. And so we need to create spaces where a secular approach to the environment, a religious approach to the environment, a spiritual approach to the environment all get us there. Yeah. So how do we go there? What does Awaken do? It starts with an hour of meditation. Now, meditation is equally accessible to secular, religious, and spiritual people. And it all opens them all to a greater reality which they can understand in their own terms. So the beauty of silence, the beauty of art for that matter, the beauty of music, the beauty of these powerful, powerful forces is that they open us regardless of which metaphor we privilege. So, and for me, for example, you know, Zen Buddhism or Buddhism more broadly is you know, it it's either a philosophy or a religion, depending on how you look at it, or a spiritual path, but it doesn't require a god of any kind. It just requires opening oneself, being curious to where silence takes you. So that's my first point, is just that that the environment to me is too important to allow it to only be defined in one metaphor, religious, spiritual, or secular. Mm-hmm. We need to recognize that the environment is the root of life, you know, that the earth is what we require to be alive, and that the 100 different diseases and disorders of our time, which we explore through the Collaborative on Health and the Environment at Commonweal, a network of 5,000 scientists and health professionals and concerned people around the world, the whole network of all these diseases, they're all linked, and they're all linked to the environment. And so there's a fundamentally holistic relationship between what happens to the earth and what happens to human health. So I personally deeply believe in what you and I, in our metaphor, would call the spiritual dimension of this. But I also believe that we shouldn't privilege the spiritual language, and that we need to recognize that the same depth of commitment to the environment and to human health can be held by secular, religious, and spiritual people alike.
That's lovely. That's lovely. Beautifully said. And in the way you're speaking, I have a feeling this is not going to be in any way a new idea for you, but it's something I don't hear much about, and that is, in terms of thinking about the environment, the problems of the environment, that there's something completely analogous. The outer environment, there's something completely analogous to that, and the inner environment. Our inner environment is subject to toxic waste and so forth. And I think that somehow implied in what you're talking about, that's already right there. Is that, would you say the inner and the outer environment have almost exactly analogous issues?
I would indeed say that. In other words, I would absolutely say that. I mean, when we think about the fundamental questions of the outer environment, you know, we know what humanity needs to do, right? It's not a secret. We need to solve the problem of war. We need to solve the problem of poverty. We need to solve the problem of justice. And we need to solve the problem of the misuse of resources on Earth. Now, we could do a bigger list than that, but that will do. You know, justice including gender issues and so forth. But war, poverty, justice, and resources is a pretty reasonable list. And if we were all functioning through deeper contact with not only the individual soul, but the group soul or the planetary soul, depending on whatever language you want to use, we would move toward resolution of these questions, and we would become what humanity is actually intended to be on this earth. So that is a fundamental reflection of what you just asked about, that our inner environment, how we understand ourselves and our purpose in this world, is fundamentally related to whether we're going to solve the great problems. It's easy to despair about it, but it's much more interesting to live with hope about it, because regardless of whether or not we win in the end, we will have aligned ourselves with the higher purpose of being human. Yeah. And we can't control whether the higher purpose of being human will overcome the tremendous forces of corporate greed and so forth, or whether they won't. And it seems to, you know, one thing I want to say here is there is a great tendency in our communities in this time to withdraw from political engagement because it looks so hopeless. And I have to say that for myself, I respect that, I honor the reasons for it, but I don't think we get to withdraw from political engagement. All the great advances in human history over the last 500 years, the movement from dictatorship to democracy, from women as property to women as equals, from laborers as serfs to labor unions and, you know, freedom to organize, the human rights movement, the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the animal rights movement, all these expansions of mutually respectful consciousness, without exception, have required political engagement. And so to me, our community needs to be particularly careful that in our interest in contemplative practice and, you know, sort of the softer dimensions of this, that we don't forget that the world calls us to engage and that that is the way that progress is made.
Well, I didn't doubt that your background in political science had somehow gone away.
No, it hasn't gone away.
That these things are intertwined deeply.
They are profoundly. If I can take just a moment right now to talk to you about something that many of your listeners may not have heard about. There is this huge thing going on now. So-called trade agreements between the United States and Asia and the United States and Europe, the transatlantic and transpacific trade agreements, these are unbelievable corporate power grabs, to put it a little bit bluntly. Yeah. In the name of free trade, which everybody thinks is a good idea, it's actually not about free trade at all. It is about creating an irreversible corporate structure or structure that once it is in place, it overrides all national and local laws designed to protect everything you can possibly imagine, from, you know, local content laws to, you know, the ability to mine and frack wherever corporations want to, you name it. And so for those who are interested, I really encourage people to wake up as people, to awaken as people in Europe and Asia and the United States are slowly awakening, that right this minute there's this huge effort to fundamentally compromise the future of democracy, of health, environment, and justice. And the only way we stop it is by engagement. So I just give that as an example that in Europe, people have awoken to this, and it's become a big issue. In the United States, it's virtually unknown. In Asia, some people in Australia and elsewhere are awakening. But these incredible agreements that would create corporate governance of people and the resources of the earth are just one of the great battlegrounds of our time. And I encourage people to discover what's going on and get involved.
Well, thank you for sharing that very, very alarming information, which I'd heard a bit about. It is very disturbing to contemplate this corporate greed and power. So I feel that right there's a link between environment and justice, that there's a great deal of injustice in the world. I guess there always has been. So thank you for bringing that out. Getting back to education and the arts. The arts play a role in what you're doing at Commonweal, and I wonder if you could share any of your insights about how the arts are useful and valuable.
For us in the healing work, the arts are fundamental, there are two different ways of looking at art. One is as a, you know, kind of professional, finished product that is for sale or whatever. But the point is that it's something that artists as professionals do. The other is a movement of consciousness within us all that expresses through art. And so we speak of the healing arts or the expressive arts, which we use all the time in the Cancer Help Program and Rachel Remen's program and so on, through mediums like sand tray, which is a Jungian technique where you have a little box full of sand and all these objects, figures, and so forth that someone can place in the sand, and they place them in the sand, and the objects tell a story. And it's a way of accessing the unconscious the way dreams are and other things are. But that's just one healing art. But one can do it through movement. One can do it through music. One can do it through drawing. One can do it through journaling. The expressive arts, the focus is not a finished product that is beautiful. The expressive arts are about using the arts to explore the individuation process or the healing process to enable us to see what is going on inside us that isn't accessed by words or by cognitive thought. Mm-hmm. So to us, the arts are integral part of the healing process and the individuation process. And by the way, I would say that for those who study depth psychology, that the healing process and the individuation process are essentially inseparable. That the way we become who we were intended to be by a greater and greater awareness of our own soul force is through the healing process, which is the same as the individuation process, and the expressive arts or the healing arts are one of the fundamental tools for that, just as silence and meditation are, and just as following inner intuitions that come to us in meditation or in dreams and point the way from the lower self, if you will, to the soul force within each of us, which is the place from which we are intended to live.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that.
This has been fascinating, Michael and Richard, listening to this conversation.
Thank you, Kanchan. Thank you for your help.
There's so much. I just need to listen to the recording later and kind of, there's so many nuggets in there that it's hard to kind of absorb all that in one.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just amazing.
It's overwhelming. In a good way, the best way.
So before I kind of open up the queue, I just had a question for myself. You touched upon, you know, all this that is happening in the world. You're aware of all the issues and still approaching it with hope and not with despair. And this is something that I personally struggle with. And I was just wondering, how do you kind of navigate that? How do you, what personally do you do to not get caught up in despair, but kind of take action with hope?
Well, thank you for that. That's one of the fundamental questions, Kanchan, that we all face in our time. And so how I look at it, I found this and from Václav Havel, the great Czech playwright and statesman, who spent a lot of time in prison under the communist regime and then became president and prime minister of the Czech Republic. And Havel said there's a fundamental distinction between optimism and hope. He said optimism is the belief that everything is going to go right. He said hope, by contrast, is a deep orientation of the human soul that can be held in the darkest of times. I just want to repeat that. Optimism is the belief that everything is going to go right. Hope, by contrast, is a deep orientation of the human soul that can be held in the darkest of times. And to me, there's a fundamental truth in that. So if you ask me, am I optimistic, my answer would be not particularly. But if you ask me, am I hopeful, I would say yes. I am profoundly hopeful. And in fact, the greater the wound, the greater my hope. That no matter how great the wound becomes, I have seen in 30 years in the Cancer Help Program that people who, this week is a good example, who, you know, in terms, who maybe have a, you know, metastatic cancer that the likelihood of cure is extremely remote. But hope is alive and well. And hope is moving them into this soul consciousness. And they are having some of the most profound experiences of their lives about what this life is really about. So I don't know how the world is going to turn out, but you know, human beings are what they call a weedy species. That is to say that human beings can survive under all kinds of circumstances. And I have a feeling that there's a very good chance that humans will survive. The question is, how much of the world will we destroy in our survival, and how can we become not destroyers, but create all over the world the equivalent of Noah's arks, you know, of arks where we carry as much of life with us through these dark times as we can. And I believe we are doing this. I believe that the awakened community, the service space community, is a force for this. And I believe there are many other strands around the world, and that we are awakening to each other and awakening to the fact that ineluctably this is our task. This is what we're given. And we're given, you know, the greatest task that we could ask for. And so hope is intrinsic to following that task through. We have no choice. Hope is the only way to do it.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Good morning. My name is Pallavi. I'm calling from San Jose. And Michael and Richard, this is so rich. I am rendered speechless, and I have goosebumps. I could listen to this all day, every day. and my question for you, Michael, is centered around the wounded healer archetype. What I've discovered in my experience, in my personal experience, is the wound helps you awaken. And once you awaken, if you stay present, you can actually avoid getting wounded again. You know, you stay aware and you don't pick up any more wounds, and it's related to victim consciousness. And so once I've gotten to that place, my deepest heartbreak is watching children, because I recognize that, you know, in their innocence, they already tap into that higher self. They are not wounded. And our society, environment, and a lot of it probably parental conditioning and, you know, two generations passes on those wounds. So I was wondering what your thoughts were about maybe not getting wounded to start with versus how that relates to this archetype that has survived through time.
Well, Kalavi, that's a beautiful question. And it's cause for deep reflection. I think I would say that it is absolutely true what you say, that that if we allow ourselves to move into the consciousness that the wound may enable us to create, to move into, that we are less likely to be wounded in the same way again. And I agree with that. I think the place that I would go beyond that, or at least for me personally, and this is personal, is that at least for me, I haven't reached a point where the wounding process ends. It's what happens for me is that life keeps presenting me with things that hurt. And therefore, for me, and for Carl Jung and Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, let me just quote Patanjali. I've mentioned Jung. You know, that one of the greatest of the Yoga Sutras is Patanjali says, "The acceptance of our suffering as an aid to spiritual growth, the study of great wisdom teachings, and complete surrender to the divine force within each of us, these three things are yoga in practice." Okay? And so for me, I agree with you that wounding can lead us to a place where we are less likely to be wounded in many respects. But for me, at least, suffering is pretty intrinsic to being alive. And so the wounding continues. And yes, it is very hard to watch children and know that they, too, will need to be wounded. I think that skill is helping ourselves and others recognize the purpose of our suffering and to be skillful to avoid it as much as possible, but recognize that it will continue and it will continue to be part of our growth. There may well be people who reach a point that is beyond suffering, but for me, I haven't gotten there. I don't know if that's helpful.
It is. Thank you
so much.
Dr. Lerner, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and experience. I'm glad you brought up the archetypes. And for me, you know, one of the major archetypes is hero journey of Joseph Campbell.
Right.
And I kind of think about like what King Arthur told his knights when they went to seek the Grail. And he said, go into where the forest is darkest. And I'm wondering if in your journey, if you've had to go into where the forest is darkest and confront, you know, that shadow. I know you left tenure track Yale. I know that you had a heart attack. And if you did go into where the forest is darkest, what gave you that courage and that persistence to stay the course?
Well, thank you, Kozo, for that. And first think of me as Michael, please. The doctor part got lost somewhere along the way after I left. The hero's journey, you're absolutely right, is along with the wounded healer and, you know, one of the great, great archetypal, and the experience of love is one of the great archetypes. And yes, I think for all of us, and here again I want to return to the archetypal experience rather than my own personal experience. I think for all of us that it is in that dark forest that we find the opening. You know, I've had many experiences of, I actually don't think of them as darkness. I think of them as loss. I've had experiences of loss in my life. And I think loss, before you get to the opening, requires grieving. It requires allowing yourself to just, you know, what I do is I say to myself, okay, how can I get through the coming day? And then I know it'll be different tomorrow. And then how do I get through the coming 4 days? How do I get through the coming week? I know that the whole thing will be different in a year. And so for a while, I just have to try to breathe through the pain until, you know, I can, and know, and the hope here, because the hope is there, is that I know this wound can open to the light. So I know that the darkest place in the forest can open to the light. So I just have to breathe through it and allow myself to grieve until I begin to see the opening. So that's how I do it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Hello, this is Sandy. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, hi. Thank you for receiving my call. Very happy to be here. Very interesting, the focus. I like the when you mentioned the art as a healing tool. I think life is art, really. So my way of seeing my healing and in life is applying that art. I apply my art when I'm cooking, when I go outside and enjoy the views. It's a way of focusing and enjoying a healing, because every time you feel good, you're healing. You will feel good. You will restore your body when you're doing that, right? Meditation helps you do that, feeling happy, finding reasons to be happy, all that. And life has taught me that if I connect in that way with other people, it will help them heal too. So Many years ago, I questioned everything regarding religion, being raised as a Catholic, and I thought one day I'd get my answers. And I've received many answers through the years, and the healing process has been going on to the point where I can say I'm very happy. There are many challenges in life. I still have quite some challenges. But as you grow into that healing and kind of focus on a positive point of view, I think that's how you'll find the healing will go further, and maybe the pain will kind of lessen. And yes, you cannot solve all the problems of the world, but you can always do something in your community with the people you associate, sending out prayers, in any which way you can, you know, doing charity. That's what I do. I fill my days that way. I'm retired today, so I have more time available to grow, bring out the beauty within me, all that healing that is helping me be in wellness, and project that to others and help others do the same. I think one of the things that I find, and I found because I've dedicated myself to healing as a fact, healing at a distance and so on, you know, energetically, I found that people tend to think like only a few people can do that. So that limiting thought will limit, obviously, their healing. So the idea would be to try, like you're doing now, trying to help others open to that growth, to know that they can heal. And there are many tools today with which we can heal. So that's
very helpful, Sandy. Thank you. And let me try to respond to a little of it. First of all, I completely agree with you that life is an art. I think that's a fundamental insight that I share with you. A place that I am so grateful you have through this found happiness and health and help others be happy. For myself, and maybe it's because of the work that I do, not everybody I work with is healthy. The people with cancer are not healthy. And not everybody I work with is happy. To me, there's a distinction between optimism and hope. There's a distinction between happiness and joy. And whereas happiness, to me, I'm happy when things go well. But I can feel joy even in the midst of suffering. And I can feel joy even when health is not going in the direction that I would wish. So for me personally, and this is a very personal statement, I seek a relationship to my life and to my work that is beyond health and happiness, and that it resides in the possibility of including suffering, of including loss, of including loss of health, in a perception that all of it is part of being human, and that what I celebrate is our humanity, because our humanity is not all good, you know? It is not all positive. We have this, all these different parts of ourselves, but our beauty as human beings is that all these different parts contribute to the sort of magnificent power of our ability to be of service in the face of all our different dimensions. And so somehow for me, Sandy, I share with you the vision of life as an art. And for me, that art is all-inclusive, not only of happiness but of sadness, not only of joy but of suffering. Not only of health, but of the fact that we are mortal and that that is part of what we all share.
And that is called life.
And that is called life.
That's right. That's what it is.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Arye from Half Moon Bay. Michael, I want to also count myself among those who've been profoundly moved listening to the conversation. I relate very much to your metaphor of Noah's Ark as communities who are coming together to do what we can to heal the woundedness of our planet right now, and with Service Space is such a wonderful example. And I've been involved in Service Space in another community. So here's my question. What has been your experience of the shadows that come along in these Noah's Arks as we come together? What kinds of obstacles have you seen coming up in communities, and how does a community deal with these shadows?
That's such a great question. Thank you for that. Yeah, I like the metaphor of Noah's Arks around the world, being built around the world. Some people speak of lifeboat communities. You may have heard that phrase as well. I think we have to engage politically to do what we can at, you know, the political level. But the fact of the matter is that corporations are not going to save us, governments are not going to save us, that the real lifeblood of our lives is in our communities, whether we're talking of geographic communities or communities of shared interests like Service Space around the world. And so, yes, a shadow absolutely emerges in all communities. Shadow is a part of it. And in my experience, actually, shadow gets more concentrated when people try to ignore its reality. So, you know, very often in some kinds of religious or spiritual communities, where people try so hard to, live in the light, shadow tends to pool. Whereas I prefer to live in a community which acknowledges our imperfection as a fundamental dimension of who we are. And therefore, shadow tends to be more integrated. It doesn't pool as much because nobody is putting themselves on a pedestal as a spiritual teacher, and no group of the elect is saying that somehow they've figured out a better way of being human. So for me, I just prefer, and this is the archetypal psychology tradition, it's the Jungian tradition, I prefer the integration of shadow to the pooling of shadow. I think it is much more destructive when we follow leaders who turn out to be human and we're all vastly disappointed than when we recognize that whoever is a servant leader in the community, as opposed to a guru, a servant leader is in fact as radically imperfect as each of us is, and that goes with the territory of being human. So that's my approach, preferring integrated shadow, recognizing that we're all, you know, just walking disaster areas of one kind or another. And yet, even in the midst of our imperfection, we are able to be of service, we're able to be kind, we're able to make a contribution.
Beautiful, thank you.
Could I just ask for clarification, when you say pools, are you saying P-O-O-L-S or P-O-L-S?
Yes, pools, okay. Pools. Okay. Yeah, that shadow pools in a sense that, rather than being kind of like woven through the fabric of a community, that we say, you know, oh, so-and-so's a piece of work, but he's really good at what he does, or she's really good at what she does, that we're able to recognize that, at least in my experience, without exception, we all have shadow. Mm-hmm. And I just deeply prefer recognizing that, because then we don't disappoint each other, or at least we don't disappoint each other as much. And so when it turns out that somebody's wounded in a way we didn't expect, we can think, oh. But, you know, I just know that shadow is a fundamental part of my own life and the part of everybody I work with, and I'd prefer to look at it that way than try to see ourselves as people who have somehow transcended the human condition.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, Mark Dubois here.
Hey, Mark.
I do. It's so moving to hear you, and just the gifts you're sharing for all of us, just wow, what a powerful gift you continue to share and contribute to all of our awakening. I'm going to try to make this brief. Gilding used the word hope in a different way when he wrote The Great Disruption, How Climate Change Brings About an End to Shopping and a Better World. And he said, hope is the most powerful political force on the world. The biggest political changes have been brought about by Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela. And he said that these men were imbued with hope. And I found myself wanting to challenge him in that, to me, it wasn't that they just had hope for humanity. To me, they had this profound, deep, deep knowing of who we are meant to be, that we are powerful beyond measure. And there, it was more their knowing of that rather than hope. And I wanted just your reflections on that, if I could, knowing we're close to the end of your time.
Mark, who did you say wrote that?
Paul Gilding, an Aussie who
worked with
Greenpeace, and it's a powerful book.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting, and I think let me just take that less as a question and more as a beautiful observation. I share with him, as I've said, a sense of the power of hope. But I also agree with you that what each of them offered was more than hope. Let me just quote Gandhi, one of my favorite Gandhi quotes. Somebody once asked Gandhi how he seemed to always know what the British were going to do before they did it. And he said, I know because I'm that kind of rascal. So it was Gandhi saying that he had within him the same realpolitik, you know, cold capacity to see how power was moving, and therefore to be able to predict the next power moves of the imperial power. And so recognizing it within himself, it was no longer shadow, right? It was, and surely we could say the same of Nelson Mandela and the others. These people didn't get to be who they are without seeing power like a geometry spread out on the space and understanding how power worked. And so they had hope, but they also were in contact with the gritty human capacities. And the question is not do we have those within us, but do we put our understanding of those into service to life?
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Dan out in Connecticut, and I want to thank everyone who's participating in the call. It's just so satisfying. My question is that I'm curious if there are resources or organizations that take a much more global or at least a non-American perspective of what's going on. I think a lot of our own sorrow and disappointment may be attributable to, you know, simply getting everything from an American bias, but I know that there are countries who do health care better, education better, environmental issues better. What resources might we tap to learn about what they're doing?
Well, that's a great question. There are so many. Ashoka, Bill Drayton's Ashoka, Entrepreneurs for the Public, which created the concept of social entrepreneurs, which the Skoll Foundation and so many others are doing, is just one. Médecins Sans Frontières, Physicians Without Borders, all over the world, moving into places like that. The Quaker Friends Service Committee, all over the world. In fact, the Quakers are such a great example of a community of people who started with silence and developed this incredible, they remind me, the thing that's so beautiful to me about Service Space and Awaken is that it's in the tradition of the Quakers that you start with silence, you hold silence in community, and then out of that comes an intrinsic need to serve. And so for me, those are three examples, Ashoka, the Quakers, Physicians Without Borders. These don't have a U.S.-based consciousness. And I agree with you that the U.S.-based consciousness is a tremendous limitation. I tend to read newspapers from around the world online just to get all the different perspectives. But I am radically uncomfortable with a U.S.-based view of the world.
Thank you.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Michael. This was a fascinating conversation, and all the questions were wonderful. I'm going to hand it over to Richard one more time to kind of make any closing comments that you have, and then we will close the call with a minute of silence like we did the beginning. So I'm handing it over to Richard.
Richard? Well, thank you, Kanchan, and Michael, thank you. Thank you so much. This has just been extraordinary. I just had a question. I wondered how does a closing question, how does the land itself in Bolinas and Point Reyes there, that beautiful land, what role does that play for you?
Yeah, what a great question. Well, first, Richard, thank you. This, and thank you, Kanchan, and thank you all for such a wonderful experience. And before I close with the land, let me just say that those who'd like to follow our work and join our community and knit us all more closely together, if you go either to commonweal.org and click on the new school or anything else you want, but click on the new school, it's free to join. There are 200 podcasts online, and we welcome you. So you can also go to www.tns for the new school.commonweal.org, and it will take you right there. And we just welcome the further weaving of the awakened service-based community and our community. As for the land is sacred, and it grounds us in our community of West Marin and Bolinas, and it's a stunningly beautiful site. If you go to the website, we've, you know, got 100 acres overlooking the Pacific with a retreat center and our 12 programs. The land is our mother, and it is sacred. And there are so many other sacred places around the world. And so I see us as just one tiny minor acupuncture point in all the acupuncture points around the world where together we are moving our needles in the piece of earth where we're placed and working toward a wholeness that just calls us all. So I'm so grateful to be part of this community and look forward to much work together in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard, for that lovely question. And before we go to the minute of silence, Michael, I was wondering, is there something we, Service Space Awaken, as a community can do to support your wonderful work in so many areas?
Oh, what a great question. If I were to, yes, there is something you can do, which is to help us think about how we can be more sophisticated in our web presence. And I'd love to explore that with you further.
Okay. Thank you. I will definitely keep that in mind.
Yes.
Thank you, everyone, again. And let's enjoy a minute of silence before I open it up for all of you to say a collective thank you to Michael. Okay, so at the count of three, we are all going to say thank you, Michael, or anything else that comes to your heart. One, two, three.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Yay. Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. Bye. Thank you.